KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. New scientific studies confirm the Pacific Northwest is due for a megaquake, so how do we prepare ourselves? We're going to find out more in about 15 minutes. Seattle's venerable Egyptian Theater will stop showing movies next week, at least in its present incarnation. Landmark Theaters, which operates the Egyptian and several other local cinemas, was unable to reach a lease agreement with building owner Seattle Central Community College. Landmark's operated the Egyptian since 1989, but the historic building on Seattle's Capitol Hill was a cinema before then. You may remember it as an early home to the Seattle International Film Festival. The theater was remodeled a couple decades ago, but these days it's tough going for single-screen, first-run movie houses. Joining us to talk more about the Egyptian closure is Justin Carter. He's publisher of Capitol Hill Seattle, the neighborhood blog which broke the story over the weekend. Hi, Justin.
Good morning.
The closure announcement seems very sudden. When was it made?
Well, I mean, the announcement was made in, I guess, kind of a grassroots style. Staff started talking about it with moviegoers in kind of an impromptu, it sounds like, decision to make a little announcement to the audience Saturday night before the midnight movie.
Which didn't screen, I understand.
Well, in a strange little twist, the announcement actually caused a digital timer to expire on their copy of Casablanca, and so the screening actually never happened.
So the screening didn't happen. The audience goers left going, oh my gosh, our neighborhood theater's about to close.
And the word began to spread.
Seattle Central Community College owns this building. Had they tried to raise the rent?
Officials say no. It wasn't an instance where rents were changing. It was an instance where the tenant was ready to move on. And who knows how the negotiation actually played out, whether there were other offers or other solutions that were on the table. But in the end, Landmark decided to walk away from the space.
Is this building a historic landmark?
It is not yet, but it is, and it also depends on which database of historic properties you want to look at. I believe it's considered a character structure here in the city, but it is something that could eventually make, probably a case could be made from the federal level and the national database of historical properties. It's something that would probably qualify given its age. I believe it was built in 1915 and its history as kind of a cultural center for the neighborhood.
The building also houses classrooms for Seattle Central. Do they use the theater itself?
They do not currently, but one of the things that has occurred with more frequency is the school stretching into some of its alternative spaces that it also owns around the hill. An example would be the Broadway Performance Hall. That performance space is frequently used for lectures and forums and such. So, I mean, that could be one possible outcome of this, is that we might see Seattle Central putting the Egyptian space to use for academic purposes in the near term.
The light rail station is being built just a couple of blocks from where the Egyptian sits. Did that have any impact on the future of this theater?
Apparently not, though it's unclear. I mean, there is a sound transit element. There's an easement for the tunnel underneath the property. That's pretty common, turns out, for a lot of the larger structures in the area. There's a ton of development going on just all around the space. And so, of course, there's a lot of speculation in the community now about the future of this building and how it is at least threatened by the opportunity of further development. You know, it's underutilized compared to some of the properties or the plans for the properties in its immediate vicinity.
It is very close to the Pike Pine Corridor, and there's at least one developer in that neighborhood who has, Liz Dunn, who has taken historic structures, whether they're landmark or not, and sort of reimagined them and hasn't torn them down necessarily. So there's couple of kinds of development going on in the neighborhood.
Sure. I mean, I think that's one of the elements here. Is we've had the big funeral in this teleplay, and now the hero springs back to life. I think there are lots of possibilities for a good future for this building. Not just Liz, Hunter's Capital also takes that kind of tack at building in the neighborhood. And so there, you know, there could be an opportunity here to make this this building kind of have its next life on Capitol Hill.
I know in the blog, the reporter who'd been following the story talked with the folks from Landmark, and they say one of the issues is that single-screen theaters, this was a 600-seat movie theater, that the economics just don't pencil out. But there is the company runs another theater on the other end of Broadway, the Harvard Exit. What's the future of that one?
Yeah, we're told right now from Landmark that the plan is to continue to operate the Harvard Exit. We've not been able to reach the landlord who owns that building to confirm anything at this point. So, yeah, I think a lot of people should be concerned about the Harvard Exit's future also. The economics of movies has transitioned, and these buildings are not the cheapest, most efficient buildings to run a theater in. So, you know, rallying around the Harvard Exit may be a more efficient use of the community's energy at this point. It's still alive and it's still showing films.
I know that a lot of people want to use video streaming services, you know, movies on demand, or maybe even rent films, as archaic as that might be. Do you think there is a future as for businesses on Capitol Hill or maybe anywhere else in Seattle for cinema, for going to a movie with people and sitting in a theater?
Well, I'm certain if it's going to happen anywhere, the Capitol Hill is the kind of neighborhood where it should succeed in some format. This is a community where one of the big themes is living outside of your kind of living space. You have your bed and your bathroom and your sink at home, and then you go out into the world to have your beer or have your coffee and do your work and hang out. And, you know, taking that living room kind of metaphor and moving it out, there needs to be a place to go and watch movies. And so I would think that a theater, properly positioned and outfitted with the right technology should be able to make a go of it here. But if it can happen here, then you really have to wonder if it's gonna continue to survive anywhere.
What impact do you think the closure will have on your readers in particular? Have you heard from them?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a lot of hand-wringing and gnashing of teeth and sadness. This is coming at a time where Capitol Hill is losing a lot of kind of the bigger names of its past culture. Things like the Broadway Grill are gone now. And so it kind of comes in a chain of that, and it's hard not to see it in that light. It feels like the general direction is sadness and badness of losing these things. We forget sometimes about all the new things that are also opening. So you also, though, will know that a lot of people in the comments will admit that while they're really sad, they haven't been to the Egyptian in a really long time. I was trying to remember the last time I'd gone, and I know it was a White Stripes documentary to tell the truth. And so it's been a long time even for me. So I think at the same time, while we're sad about it, I think a lot of people are realistic in that. Well, we may not have been going as much as we could have or should have or feel like a movie experience would be exciting for us. You know, it's just not something we do as much anymore.
Well, I want to go back just as a last question to what you said right before that, which is that the neighborhood is changing a lot. There's a lot of development. What do these historic buildings and businesses, what role do they play in the character of the neighborhood itself? And what does Capitol Hill lose when something new comes in?
I think I'll take a kind of real simple approach to answering that. One of the biggest changes is just simple physical layout. The new structures are optimized in a way to that the retail and even the way the living is set up inside of them is about kind of the maximum return on investment. It's been just kind of battlefield optimization that's happened over time. And what that means is kind of small, funky, cheaper kinds of layouts and things, those disappear. And so I do think that element of loss on the Hill is real. And I think that's one of the things that people are reacting to when they get sad about these kinds of things.
Justin, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Justin Carter is publisher of the neighborhood news website Capitol Hill Seattle. Capitol Hill Seattle broke the story that the Egyptian Theater is closing on June 27th. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
How to get yourself and your family prepared for an earthquake in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor organic garden supplies and hydroponics, featuring grow lights, organic earthworm castings, and sunshine mix, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
64 degrees in Seattle, partly cloudy, a little bit of sun at the moment. Forecast calls for a chance of showers through the day, the possibility of a thunderstorm this afternoon, and a high of 71. Later this hour, we're going to green things up with our organic gardening panel, flowers, native plants, and veggies. You've got questions about growing, pruning, harvesting, they've got answers. Stick around, that's 15 minutes away.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. We don't know where or when the next big earthquake will strike the Puget Sound region, but scientists are certain that we're due for one. And when that earthquake comes, you're going to want to be as prepared as you possibly can be. So we have asked John Schelling to talk with us. He's the Earthquake Tsunami Manager for the Washington State Emergency Management Division. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Marcy.
So ever since the Nisqually earthquake hit in 2001, we've had people come in, talk to people on the phone to talk about preparedness, but some of us maybe didn't get prepared. So again, John, where do we start preparing for what seems unthinkable?
Well, it's probably the most important thing is just to do something. There's a number of different activities that you can do. To try and make things easier, we've created a program called Prepare in a Year. So, for example, you just do one thing per month to help get you and your family ready for an earthquake or the things that happen more frequently, like winter storms.
Okay, so what's the first thing that we might start with, first task?
Well, I would start by putting together some sort of family preparedness plan. I don't think, you know, people have this notion that it has to be something extravagant. It really doesn't. It can be something very easy, you know, just a 8.5 by 11 piece of paper with the things that you would want you would want your family to do, where you would meet up, for example, after an earthquake. You might be separated. So, you know, having a primary and an alternate location, you know, if you have pets and maybe your home is damaged, you know, what hotels accept pets around you? You know, have contact information on there for doctors and schools and the things that you would want to have, and keep it with you. Keep it in your wallet or on your smartphone.
How much food, water, et cetera, do we need?
Well, we recommend, and these are minimums, you know, at least 3 gallons per person, you know, and that'll keep you comfortable for about a 72-hour period. Certainly, you know, trying to do more is great. If you have the resources to do so, you know, having some basic food stuff that don't require a lot of preparation, you know, things like oatmeal, for example. And if you have kids, it's a great way to get them involved in sort of emergency preparedness. Have them help to put together the family emergency kit, since the food and the snacks and stuff that they'll be eating, you know, if the power's out, you know, from a winter storm or an earthquake, you know, they'll give them some input into that, since, you know, you don't want to hear them complain afterwards. And
well, they probably will be. What kind of container would you put that in?
Well, we recommend putting it into something that's portable. So it could be broken down into a backpack or a couple of backpacks, some sort of, you know, plastic bin or tote. But if you had to take it out of your house and take it someplace, you could do that, easily load it into your car. It's also, you know, prudent to keep, you know, some emergency supplies in your car. So, for example, if you're at work, when something happens, you do have, you know, just the basics to keep you comfortable.
What about things like personal papers, money even?
Having copies of, you know, your important documents, your mortgage, your bank account information, all of that is going to be really critical. So with the you know, ability to just snap a picture with your smartphone, you can just take a picture and have it with you, or if you've got a scanner at home, download it onto a thumb drive, and just throw that in your kit. So you have those kinds of really important documents with you, accessible. So if you do need to access them after an earthquake, you've got all that information in an easy-to-access place.
We're talking with John Schelling of the Washington State Emergency Management Division, and clearly I've watched one too many apocalypse movies, John, because I'm imagining that that I won't be able to plug a thumb drive into anything because there won't be power, or that I won't be able to get money out of an ATM if a 9.0 earthquake should hit.
Well, having power will be down for a while, certainly in a magnitude 9 earthquake. Trying to at least have those things accessible, so as generators are being used and commercial institutions like banks and whatnot begin to get power restored, you can have that accessible. Having a small supply of cash on hand is certainly advisable. ATMs, and we saw this with the winter storms just a few years ago when we had power going out, so that certainly these things may be more widespread during an earthquake. So having those types of supplies, like important documents, a small supply of cash, probably smaller bills, is certainly a good addition to your emergency preparedness kit.
Were just talking to Sandy Doughton of the Seattle Times in the last hour. She's just written a book about the very good possibility that we're going to experience a big quake sometime soon in our lifetimes, perhaps. And one of the things I wonder in listening to her speak is how prepared structure-wise we are in the central Puget Sound region, anywhere from Olympia up to, say, Mount Vernon, Bellingham. We have codes that have been put into place, so can we assume that most of the buildings will withstand a certain amount of shaking?
Well, the seismic provisions began making their way into the building codes in Washington State back in about the 1950s. So they've been around for quite some time, and they continually are revised and assessed, especially after an earthquake, wanting to make sure that they're up to par. I think one of the things, looking historically at earthquakes in places like Japan, New Zealand, for example, have very similar building codes to us. Newer modern structures do great, especially smaller wood frame buildings like homes. It's the older, more legacy type of buildings like unreinforced masonry or older brick buildings that we typically see the most damage in during an earthquake. One of the things that probably is the most likely to hurt somebody during an earthquake isn't necessarily the building itself. It's the contents within the building that move around. So making sure that you know to drop cover and hold on when the shaking starts and fight that instinct to run is really going to be your best safety action.
We're not supposed to stand in a door frame.
No, that's that's sort of older advice. What the best advice that exists today is being able to get underneath a sturdy table or a desk if it's accessible. If not, you want to try and move away from windows and glass and things like that that could pose a hazard or things that could fall on you. Which is a reminder that as we look around our houses and our offices, just to do the real simple things about, buying some of those little plastic straps that you can anchor, your bookcases, your televisions, those types of structural contents that really pose the greatest risk to people, to the wall. So we recommend those types of what we call non-structural mitigation, or, just anchoring things like bookcases, TVs, appliances if they're stacked, so that they don't fall and hurt people.
This is a personal question that I have. In 2001, when the Nisqually quake hit, I was walking outside in downtown Seattle by the Sheraton Hotel, and I knew something was up because I saw the big plate glass pane start shimmying. When you are in an area like that, where should you go?
Well, I try and think about a similar situation. If I was in downtown Seattle, what would I do? Looking at, a lot of the parapets that may pose a hazard, wanting to maybe move away from very close to the building, certainly not right out into the street, but, maybe as far away on the sidewalk as you can get. So any of those sort of appurtenances or parts of the facade of the building that could pose a hazard as they come down, they don't injure you.
So
they do come down.
Should I stop, drop, and cover in the street?
Probably wanting to just keep alert and, you know, try and protect your head and neck. I mean, that's the most important part of us. So, you know, trying to, you know, crouch down, maybe protect your head and neck, and keep alert so, you know, you don't move into traffic or anything like that.
So after these earthquakes hit, what's the first thing we should do?
Well, I think probably the most important thing is just try to be calm. keep your wits about you and look around to see who you can help. If you, you know, are at home and or you smell a gas leak, you know, being able to shut off your gas. In fact, I keep a wrench tied to my gas meter so that I can easily crank it off if I need to. I don't want to do that if I don't have to, because it takes a professional to come back out there and restart it. So you want to make sure that, you know, there's like presence of gas before you actually go ahead and shut it off. You know, be prepared for aftershocks. The types of quakes that Sandy was talking about, you know, a subduction zone type of earthquake, they generate a lot of aftershocks. So being ready for that, both sort of mentally and then just sort of, you know, assessing your surroundings as they occur, is certainly advisable.
Now, you mentioned that building codes had been under revision for the last 50, 60 years, since the 1950s. But I know in the aftermath of the Nisqually quake, that emergency officials at all levels, state, county, local, have been holding drills in the Seattle area. What kinds of things worry you or concern you the most?
You know, as a dad, you know, I want to make sure that you know, my daughter and you know, all of the you know, kids in schools are safe. So, you know, the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction and local school districts have been doing a lot of drills, as you mentioned, to make sure that you know, kids are safe and schools have the plans in place so that, you know, when an earthquake does happen, you know, our probably most precious resource, our kids, are going to be you know, safe when it does occur.
Do you feel like you guys are ready for the big one?
Well, I don't know how you can ever be ready for the big one. I think, you know, we can try and do everything we can. You know, one of the actions that has taken place recently is the Washington State Seismic Safety Committee published a report called The Resilient Washington. And what it does is it looks over what our current sort of gaps in resilience are, essentially how long it might take us to recover from something like a Cascadia earthquake, and how we can begin to proactively, over the next 50-year period, put in place the proper sort of retrofits and ways to reduce the vulnerabilities to the built environment, you know, things like schools and hospitals and utilities. So essentially we can recover that much more quickly when something does happen.
John Schelling is the Earthquake Tsunami Manager for the Washington State Emergency Management Division. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Marcy.
We have this email from a listener, Barbara. She says, here are two things that an expert told them about earthquake preparedness. Number one, the vast majority of earthquake injuries occur in people who leap from their beds barefooted and cut themselves on glass and debris, so keep a good set of shoes or boots under your bed. Keep your supply kit, this is number two, keep your supply kit next to a bearing wall and under a window. The wall will give more protection from it being crushed in a building collapse, and if it's under a window, you have a better chance of actually being able to reach it if there is a collapse. This is Weekday on KUOW.
And try not to keep shards of glass all around your bed when you're sleeping at night, I guess.
Yep.
How do you prepare your garden for an earthquake? Well, perhaps we'll find out. We're joined by our expert gardeners in a minute.
People in Germany are pretty upset by the NSA's data surveillance program, but it's happened before. The NSA kept a listening post there during the Cold War.
We would transcribe artillery fire missions.
This man monitored East German radio traffic 50 years ago.
We didn't care what they were saying. What we cared about was who was saying it and where were they saying it from.
Eavesdropping in Berlin, next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from City People's Mercantile on Sandpoint Way and City People's Garden Store and Landscape Design in Madison Valley, offering a wide selection of plants, patio furniture, and outdoor living accessories. Locally owned for more than 30 years. More at citypeoples.com.
64 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 71 this afternoon. Forecast says expect clouds through the day, a chance of showers and possibly a thunderstorm. It's 10:31. I'm Bernard Ouellette. In what's being described as a major breakthrough, the U.S. and Taliban have agreed to hold talks on ending the war in Afghanistan. That's in the news at 11.
It is Tuesday, and just a time to breathe after all that earthquake stuff. We're going to talk about gardening with our Green Days gardening panel. Marty Wingate writes about gardening and travel. Her website, martywingate.com. Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin steward and co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. Laura Matter, practicing horticulturalist and coordinator of Seattle Tilth's Garden Hotline. And I have to say, you guys are like the time to calm, because all that talk about emergencies.
Take a deep breath.
Take a deep breath. You can call if you've got a gardening question, 206-543-5869, 206-543-KUOW, 1-800-289-5869, or email us weekday at KUOW.org. Gardens. I was happy to hear from my CSA that I get my first box of vegetables this week. So, Laura, I just have to ask you a question. This is sort of like the first local harvests coming in now?
Yeah, they're starting to pick up. I noticed that at our food bank closet at Picardo Pea Patch last week, there were things there, but it was getting slim. We were noticing lots of things in the garden, though, and so we put a little call out to people, and then all of a sudden Saturday we had pounds and pounds and pounds of greens and lettuces and tons of food starting to come in.
So mostly greens and lettuces
at
this point?
Lots of greens and lettuces, onions, leeks, rhubarb.
You're giving me a preview of what I can expect in my CSA box. One of my coworkers sent a photo that maybe in the break I'll have you guys come and look at. His cat Dempsey brought in dinner to go. It's a snake.
Oh, garter snake.
I love garter snakes.
You love garter snakes. Yeah. So it's snake season as well.
Yeah, they're good guys, those. Yeah.
I'm sure Greg is making habitat for them.
Yeah, well, it's one of the easiest things to make habitat for.
A snake?
For snakes in your garden.
Oh, Marcy's thrilled to hear that.
basically, leaving a board out on the grassy area.
A board.
They love to go under boards.
And I thought you were going to tell me they like to go on the board and sun themselves.
They'll do that also, but they'd like to also hide underneath the board. And that's really a very easy way to just leave a board out in the sun. I have one, and I have a quite healthy, large garter snake living underneath it. You can also create rock piles. So instead of making the mistake when you're out gardening and lining your beds with all the colorful small rocks you find that then weeds grow in between and they're nearly impossible to weed around, instead you can take those and just put them into a pile in a sunny part of your garden and attract garter snakes that way.
Laura, do I want snakes in my garden for any reason other than I like reptiles?
Yeah, they eat slug eggs and slugs. And
okay. So they're helpful.
They are helpful.
They're employees of mine. I hire them to care for my garden.
And what do you pay them?
Yeah. Slugs.
Slugs. 206-543-KUOW or toll-free 1-800-289-5869. Jerry in Freeland, you are on the air.
Yeah, I have kind of an interesting question, and that is I had rescued lots of the blue hybridized irises from homes, yards that were going to be destroyed. And I'd done it a number of years ago, and there was, you know, a fair amount of them. And what I've noticed is they were all blue when I originally got them, and now they're all white. Is there something that I need to put in the soil or something else to make them blue again?
Well, that's a very amazing question. It is, irises are not susceptible to the acidity of soil like hydrangeas are, as far as I know. These are the bearded iris, the ones with the thick rhizomes that grow just along almost on the surface of the ground.
They aren't as bearded as some, but they're the tall, you know, those types of irises.
Yeah. I do not know the answer to that question. It's possible that you might have had a white one in there to begin with, and the white has taken over the blue. flower colors are slightly susceptible, I think, to temperature sometimes, but any other ideas?
I don't think there'd be that big a change.
You should contact the King County Iris Society. That's who will tell you the answer to this question.
Wow.
Okay, well, it's, you know, I mean, these were like, you know, a couple hundred.
Wow.
And they're all white now.
Well, you contact King County Iris Society and then please call us up again and give us the answer to the question.
It's like a big mystery. Good luck with that, Jerry. Thanks for your call. Jerry called 1-800-289-5869. Beth emails, "Hi, the leaves on my raspberry plants are turning yellow and a bit brown. Not all, but some. They are starting to set berries, but I worry about the yellowing. I'm watering. Maybe I should water more with these hotter days, although I was reading that overwatering can cause leaves to yellow. I'm confused."
That is a really good question about watering. Raspberries, water deeply. You don't need to water every day on those. Check the soil also before you water. Dig down a little bit. If the soil's moist, don't give them a big drink. They are susceptible to different fungal issues, but also the fruit-bearing canes that are turning yellow, that's kind of typical of them too, as they start to sort of drain their energy into putting fruit on. They won't look quite as robust and fresh as all those primal canes, those little new canes that are coming up that will be next year's crop.
So essentially, do a good water. Don't just give them a little dash.
Yeah, and don't water every day.
Okay. Good luck with that, Beth. Our phone number, 206-543-5869. I just have to say, I had volunteer strawberry plants last year, and they're back, and they have little tiny sweet, sweet berries on them, which is
Are
wonderful.
They the alpine strawberries, the little ones?
They're tiny.
That's what we have, and I let them reseed everywhere. And
oh, yeah.
Every day we go up and down the concrete steps and pick a few and
yeah,
put them in
the
our
big
mouths.
Leaves, little berries.
Yes. But they're, and they take some shade.
Yes.
They're great
cover. Yes, they do take shade because that's what I have in my garden. So whatever bird came by with a strawberry seed, now I know it truly is spring. Fred joins us now from Greenwood. Hi, Fred.
Good morning. I didn't have a question. I just had a wonderful example of how powerful microclimate is to a gardener.
Okay.
I'm part of the Just Garden Project, and we build gardens for low-income people and teach them gardening. One of our gardens is at a low-income senior apartment complex, and half of it was on the sidewalk in front of the building on the north side. That's doing okay. The other half of it was right against a south-facing wall. So it's protected in winter, and it gets sunshine beaming down on it whenever there's sun and reflecting off the wall. So when we were building the garden, we told the residents, this is your tomato factory. I was there a week ago, and there are tomatoes almost ripe.
Oh, wow.
Excellent.
In the middle of June. So look around and see where you've got protection from winter winds, where you've got reflected heat. Put your peppers, your tomatoes, eggplants, if you dare, in places like that.
Okay,
wonderful.
I'd also like to invite people to come to hear Ron Finley. This is the guy, a guerrilla gardener from Los Angeles, who had a wonderful TED Talk. He's going to be speaking Thursday the 26th at Queen Anne United Methodist Church.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Fred. Appreciate it. My coworker, Jamala Henderson, has a new garden, and Fred was talking about a really tiny microclimate, but she lives in South Seattle, and I think it's warmer by a couple degrees than where I am in North Seattle because she has things much bigger than I do already. Is that possible?
Yeah, there are different microclimates certainly around the city and even within your own neighborhood. But I think that's what Fred mentioned is a really good example of an on-site change, you know, and to really evaluate your site for where things grow the best. I would point out, though, that, and this is something we struggle with when we talk to people on the garden hotline, is if you have a small space and that's the best tomato space, you still need to rotate your crops and certain types of crops, especially things in the tomato family. So you want to keep that in mind and maybe amend soil or put them in pots sometimes or even move them from one end of the bin to the other, whatever you can do to move them around a bit.
Interesting. We're talking gardening, as we do every Tuesday in the 10 o'clock hour, with Laura Matter, who you just heard, Marty Wingett, and Greg Rayburn. And Wes wants us to come back to garter snakes. Do you guys have any suggestions as to where to purchase garter snakes to repopulate a yard that's been restored to mostly native plants and habitat?
No.
I didn't know they sold garter snakes.
I'm not aware of them. Usually they don't sell native wildlife. It's not really a commodity. So it's more of a, hopefully, if you can build it and there's an area where they can be sustained, then they'll show up.
So, and if he's restored his yard to a native habitat and garter snakes are native fauna, they might find their way in?
Depending on where he's at. I mean, there's areas where if you're in kind of an ecological island, then you get the rewards of maybe pulling in new birds and butterflies, but you may not get the reptiles and amphibians.
Yeah, they have to find a way. They have to have a path.
And they have to have a large enough block of habitat.
Yes.
Your corridors. Your parcel may be big enough for you to live in, but it may not have all the range that different wildlife needs.
Unless you're a raccoon. 206-543-5869. Ursula's in Tacoma. Hi, Ursula.
Hello. Greetings to all of you. I have a question. I received some tomato plants yesterday and already have flowers on. I've been told to clip them off, so otherwise I will have only low crop. Do I need to strip them off and then I get more flowers and more tomatoes then?
I'm not clipping any tomato flowers off, let me tell you.
Yeah, sometimes when you're transplanting, if you've waited to plant till now and you have a little plant in a 4-inch pot that has some flowers, then I sometimes will clip the flowers off so I can put energy into building roots on it. But if the plant has been planted and is growing happily, you are beginning to get fruit. And I have seen things early out there, echoing what Fred said a moment ago when he called in. Tomatoes are going to be a little bit early this year. That's my prediction because I'm seeing them already.
I have pea-sized tomatoes on my SunGold.
So do I.
Yeah.
So don't do it. Unless you just got this and it's in a pot, Ursula. Are you going to plant it in the ground?
Well, so far, I just got him yesterday. He's still in about 6 or 8-inch pot.
Oh, yeah. Big enough. Don't clip them.
Yeah, no, those are big enough size. I'd go ahead and just plant them.
Okay.
Okay,
good luck and enjoy your tomatoes. Mona in Oak Harbor's with us now. Hi, Mona.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. We have a heavy infestation of tent caterpillars that hopefully are ebbing now. We're getting all their nests. But my question has to do with our potentilla. Of course, they look like they're almost dead. Can we cut those back? They're going to look bad, I think, for the rest of the season here. Can I do anything to prune them severely? Or
These are the shrubby potentillas.
Yes.
I would say wait, and they should leaf out again after the tent caterpillars have gone their way. That is most likely going to be the case. I don't think you need to prune them back.
Okay. I couldn't find anything to support them. Thank you for the call. That's just so they come back.
Good luck with that, Mona, and thanks for your call. When you said tent caterpillars, everybody nodded. Seems like they're along with Laura's prediction for early tomatoes, tent caterpillars are here. Yep. They're in a tree outside the window of the KUOW newsroom. Ooh. And so we've watched the leaves shrivel up as they've been eaten. Rhonda emails, I have a very large native dogwood that developed a disease last year. It has brown spots on the leaves that eventually shrivel and drop. It's lost a fair number of leaves. Then it stopped and everything seemed fine for the rest of the season. This year it's already lost a third to half of the leaves and it's looking pretty sad. Can this tree be saved?
Yeah, that's our native dogwoods. They haven't handled the conversion to urban areas very well and they've been very susceptible to anthracnose as one disease in particular. It's more about watching it's not necessarily a death sentence for the tree. I would encourage leaving it and seeing basically a watch and see. And never hurts to have a professional arborist come out and assess it as well. So going to plantamnesty.org and looking at their list is a great way to go.
How should she dispose of the leaves that have dropped? Is it a virus anthracnose? And does she need to, can she compost them? Should she
get? Not in her own compost, okay. No. Like, we'll put it in the yard waste collection.
Yeah,
I think it gets hot enough that it kills off pathogens.
Julie in Bellingham, you also have a dogwood question. Julie? Hi.
Hi. I have a dogwood that I planted about 5 or 6 years ago. And I don't know the kind, but it's the kind now that has the yellow-green flowers on it that are blooming now. Every spring, it starts off with these beautiful green leaves, and it looks fine. And then about the time it starts to bloom, the leaves shrivel up and curl. They never fall, but for the rest of the year, the tree is just droopy and sad-looking. And I've tried vitamins, I've tried a little root hormone, but nothing seems to really snap it out of it.
Well, if it's blooming now, it sounds like a kusa. The Cornus kusa blooms in June, a little later than our native dogwood and the native, than the eastern dogwood. Mm-hmm. But it is usually resistant to most diseases, so that's kind of still. Where is it, in sun or shade?
It's in partial shade. It's in sun in the morning and shade in the afternoon.
And the soil is on the dry side, on the wet side?
I would say that it's on the dry side, but I do try to water that area frequently when it's, you know, later in the summer when it gets a little drier.
In general, Cornus kusa likes full sun. So, I don't know if that's causing the leaves to dry up, but, and once established is a fairly low water use plant. In other words, I wouldn't water it in the summer. Maybe I don't water mine in the summer. Let me put it that way. Cornus kusa Milky Way is the one I have, and it looks fabulous. So those are two. You might want to check the soil before you water so that you're not watering too much. Hmm. When you do water landscape plants, it should be infrequently and deeply. Any other ideas?
No, that sounds about right.
You might want to take a sample into your local master gardener clinic so that the diagnosticians could take a look at it and let you know for sure if there is some disease involved.
Good luck with that, Julie. Thanks for your call. Sometimes it's just a mystery, isn't it?
Yeah.
Our phone number with our Green Days Gardening Panel, 206-543-5869, or toll-free 1-800-289-5869, or you can email us. We have many emails here today, weekday@kuow.org. Angela in Paulsbo writes, I had a deer visit, and now I have a cherry tree with very few leaves. Will my tree survive? Is there anything I can do to support it? I've already sprayed deer repellent. Maybe after the fact, a little late.
Yeah. Usually, I mean, just once again, watch the moisture. If we go for a long time without rain, you want to not stress out the tree anymore, but generally trees can handle browse pretty well. More so deer damage that I see that's fatal is from their bucks rubbing, and sometimes they'll clear off all the bark, or with really young trees where they snip them all off. But if you're interested in seeing some examples of great deer fencing, this weekend on Vashon Island is the Vashon Island Garden Tour, both Saturday and Sunday. And the people on Vashon, the gardeners there, are very well accustomed to
deer
trying to protect their greens and others from deer. So there's lots of very creative deer fences out there that can really...
That was artful. That was an artful mention.
Yeah.
I like that.
And while you're there, the Low Tide Festival is going on Sunday, so you can learn all about marine life.
Okay.
So it's a great weekend for Vashon.
Angela, just hop over. I think you can get a ferry.
Yeah.
It's making me think about yesterday morning. I row in the mornings, and a beaver had come up onto the bank and was exploring the newly planted foliage that my rowing club had cleared out all the blackberries and planted some natives. And so this beaver was checking for the most delectable part of these woody shrubs that we'd put in.
Did you guys protect them?
They didn't appear to be protected. This beaver was up on the shore ready to munch. It was, I mean, it's fun to watch, but not necessarily fun for the plants. There's a whole group of beaver that live in Fremont and the Ship Canal there.
We've had them come along in our restoration projects where we've put in a bunch of live stakes of different dogwoods and willows.
Yum, yum, yum.
And just have them pull them out and then replant them under the water, facing up, so when the pond freezes or whatever, they can just snack underneath the water. It's like a little refrigerator storage area.
We go now to Shoreline. Hi, Nico. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about a mock orange that I recently purchased and planted. It's fairly young, but it doesn't really seem to be taking off. It just feels a little, blah. And I don't know if there's anything I should be doing, or am I overwatering it or underwatering it?
And when did you plant it?
Maybe 3 weeks ago.
And do you know which mock orange it is? Did it have a special name? That doesn't matter.
Oh, I don't know.
Okay. And where did you plant it? Yeah, sun, shade?
It's sun.
Okay. And how much have you watered it?
We water it every night. We probably give it maybe a gallon or a half a gallon.
Well, I'd say cut back on the watering. You check the soil before you water. Dig your finger down in there and see how damp or dry it is. Even though it's a newly planted shrub, it still doesn't need that much water. So every few days, perhaps, you might need to water it, or then every week this summer when it gets dry, keep an eye on it. But check the soil first, because you don't want it to be sitting in soppy soil.
It's also normal for your shrub to have some transplant shock for a bit. So in 3 weeks, I wouldn't expect it to really be putting on too much new growth or taking off.
Good luck with that, Nico. Thanks for your call. MC joins us from Rainier Beach. Hi, MC.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So I have a corkscrew willow tree that over the last couple of years we've noticed has very few leaves, just a couple of wispy ones towards the end of the branches. And so we're pretty sure it's sick, but we're not sure in what way and what to do about it.
Gosh, something bothering a willow? I can't believe it. They're usually such strong growers.
I've seen decline in corkscrew willows before. I don't know if it's a fungal issue or what, but an old neighbor of mine used to have one that did slowly, sort of branch by branch, just started disappearing.
How old is the tree?
We've been in the house for 4 years. It was very big and established when we moved in, so I don't know exactly. I'm guessing 15 years. You know, it's not young.
Yeah,
we're debating about just taking it out entirely, but it is still alive. It's not dead, but I started pruning back, cutting off all the dead, you know, wispy branches, and then I started reading that maybe that's not the best choice. So,
has anything changed in the vicinity? Do you think it's getting more shade than it might have when it was younger? Like,
no.
do you see shade on it?
Well, it is a very shady area, but it always has.
That could be part of it. They actually do appreciate some sunshine. So,
well, most of the leaves are up at the very top. It's a really tall tree, like 30 feet or something, and it seems like most of them are up at the top.
The great news is willows propagate great by cuttings, and so you can just take some cuttings of the live wood and put it into some moist soil and keep it moist, and you'll grow yourself a new tree.
Oh, and put one somewhere else in the yard.
Yeah.
Really?
They readily reroot.
Okay. They used to use willow stems for root growth. They would soak them in water and then use that water to try to root other plants.
Which is why you're so surprised that this tree's not doing well. I get it now. Well, good luck with that, MC. Thanks for your call. Gina says, I have a raised vegetable garden question. My cat likes to use this as her litter box. I was told to put catnip around the sides. That didn't work. P.S., saying no doesn't help either.
Well, I just talked to somebody about this yesterday, actually, and there's a variety of things you can employ to try to keep your cats out. First of all, understanding that cats like dry, soft soil to do their business in, and changing those conditions will help. So sometimes putting things on the soil that they don't like to dig in can help. That can be as creative as, you know, artwork with bamboo stakes, or you can do a little bit of gravel, or you can do holly leaves, things that are pokey that they're not going to want to dig around in can help. Sometimes people have employed those deer repellent sprinklers. Cats do not like to be shot at with water. One of the things I offered my caller yesterday at the hotline was to employ some children with squirt guns and get out.
Because it's summer vacation now.
Because they do respond to that. But mostly making it uncomfortable for them to dig is the thing that's going to be successful.
I've had success with fresh orange peels, too. Somebody
really
mentioned that to me, and I thought, wow, that's a wives' tale. And I tried it, and it worked for me.
Good
with to know. With the cat that was the particular cat I had a problem with.
And plus, it smelled good.
Yeah.
How nice for you. Hi, Mark in Greenwood. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a Ribes sanguinea that I planted maybe 10 years ago, and I had understood that it is a native and could handle light shade, and it gradually has died off in that area and moved over in the bed into the sunnier area. Each fall, the leaves go brown around the edges and start falling off. Any issues you might think might be a problem with this?
Well, unfortunately, red flowering currant isn't one of those plants that's known for its fall color of its leaves. It really has. Its leaves do look pretty bad in the fall, and they just kind of shrivel up brown and crispy and fall. That's not its selling point. The spring blooms are fantastic. And although red flowering currant generally it can do part shade, it's going to prefer more sunlight, and it would gradually lean that way, or you might have the branches out in the sunlight doing better.
Yeah, more prevalent on the forest edge.
Exactly.
Yes.
So you're saying that Mark's plant is doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Exactly.
It wants to survive, and if this fall, if he wants to move it, although it sounds like it's really established. I mean, 10 years is a long time for red flowering currant, so you may
and
want.
And that's normal for the older ones to die off as it moves, then. Towards more light?
I would expect, for you to have some limb change over time, too. I mean, different branches would die. That doesn't sound abnormal. If you send a picture to our weekdays page, we might be able to recognize a pattern.
Yeah, it's Green Days at KUOW. What is your exact Facebook address?
Green Days.
Just Green Days. So search for that and send a picture. Or you can take a picture and email it to weekday@kuow.org. And we'll look at it with your snake photos again next week. A lot of people, sorry we couldn't get to all your calls and questions, but our gardeners will be back next Tuesday because we're in high season now. This is it. Greg Rayburn, who you just heard, is Vashon Basin Steward, co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. Laura Matter, practicing horticulturalist and coordinator of Seattle Tilth's Garden Hotline. Marty Wingate?
Wingate, thank you.
Wingate. Somebody just emailed in to say I say your name wrong. I say it right. Sorry, Ken. It's Wingate. She writes about gardening and travel, and her website, while spelled MartyWingate.com, it's Marty Wingate. Our show, produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Join us again tomorrow here on KUOW Seattle.
And in fact, why not just stick with us right now here on KUOW Seattle? It's 10:59. Better than expected financial news may help state lawmakers come to terms on a new budget. That's in the news in a moment. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Custom Pure, the water store, since 1981 committed to providing filtration systems for home and office, which are environmentally sustaining alternatives to water delivery and disposable bottles. Located in Shoreline and online at CustomPure.com.
Back in 1964, before the Voting Rights Act, Zelpha Montgomery Watley says she remembers the test that the county clerk gave to her father.
He holds up this bar soap and he says to my dad, "You gotta tell me how many bubbles are in this bar soap."
Coming up on the story, the days that led up to the passage of the Voting Rights Act.
That's this afternoon at 2 o'clock on KUOW's second program service, called, appropriately enough, KUOW2. It's on HD radio and it's online, KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Chamber Music Society, celebrating the 2013 summer.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.